Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 13th day of December 2011. And today I'm honored to be joined on the line by none other than Cynthia McKinney, the former U.S. Congresswoman from the state of Georgia and also a former U.S. presidential candidate back in the 2008 election cycle. She has been an outspoken advocate for 9/11 truth, serving as a commissioner on the 9/11 Citizens Commission, and has also accrued many accolades to her name, including, grilling Donald Rumsfeld on the trillions of dollars missing from the Pentagon's coffers during defense appropriations hearings. And she was also on the Free Gaza Movement's ship, the Spirit of Humanity, back in June 2009 when it was seized by the Israeli Navy off the coast of Gaza. Of course, she has many other accolades and credits to her name, but we have only a short interview today, so I'll leave it there. But Cynthia, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Well, thank you so much for asking me to join you.
Excellent. Well, it is good to have you here. So, Cynthia McKinney, today I want to talk about AFRICOM, the United States African Command, which was set up back in 2007, ostensibly to further security cooperation between the United States of America and the continent of Africa. But I think anyone who's seen the way that that cooperation has played out over the last few years knows that that really is not the ultimate motive behind the setting up of AFRICOM. So what is your take on why AFRICOM was established and what its real purpose is?
Well, as Cindy Sheehan would say, to provide security for the robber barons, because unfortunately the problem that exists all over the African continent is the insecurity of the people with respect to basic human needs, food and water and shelter and good governance. And instead, you've got the particular individuals who are able to wield power in Western capitals, including Washington, D.C., who are able to go in and steal the resources that ought to really accrue to the people of those countries or of that continent. So here we have a situation where the public is told one thing, and unfortunately, the reality is quite a different matter.
So looking a little bit further behind the facade that is PR front, really, of the AFRICOM, when this was set up, of course, the United States was obviously quite concerned with the optics of this African command, which obviously looks like a type of neo-colonial imperialism to many on the outside. So they have been quite careful to try to present a PR image of what AFRICOM is about. But of course, we know fundamentally it's about securing African resources in a struggle that's going on right now, for example, against China, which is also very keen on Africa's resources. So what can you say about that type of struggle that's taking place right now and how that's really shaped AFRICOM's policies?
Well, there was a time when Africa completely was in the sway of the European capitals. And thank goodness, because of the rise of other countries, the Soviet Union at that time, China, the non-aligned movement, countries that became known as countries of le tiers monde, le third world, the liberation, the force for liberation and freedom, the rhetoric of the West of making the world safe for democracy or fighting the last war, well, that was not lost on Africans who also wanted democracy. They wanted their share of no more war, no more conflict, but they were willing to fight for their freedom. And they did fight for their freedom, so much so that the forces, the colonial forces, were forced to retreat. And what that left was the dominance, because of their lack of colonial history, of the Soviet Union, now Russia, and of China. They were able to make entrees because their history lacked that colonial exploitation on the continent. And they did make entrees, and they have made entrees. And now, of course, because we still have cold warriors dominating our foreign policy apparatus, like, for example, Zbigniew Brzezinski, the motive of U.S. policy must still be the Cold Warrior attitude of denial of access, denial of resources to the two big enemies of the United States. Now, I don't view them as enemies, but these Cold Warriors still view Russia and China as enemies, and they still view the world as a chessboard. And of course, if you can't place your player, your pawn, on the square of the chessboard, then you at least deny the other pawn, the other side's pawn, to that particular square. That is what we are seeing happening on the African continent. And unfortunately, as usual, the African people are suffering.
Unfortunately so, and I think that became particularly clear in the case of Libya, where, of course, Muammar Gaddafi was being quite vocal about his opposition to AFRICOM and its intentions on the African continent. So what can you tell us about Libya, its resources, and how it's been appropriated now by the NATO forces?
Well, what we can say is what Mrs. Gaddafi has said, and I read an interview in which she said that had the Jamahiriya government said yes to an AFRICOM base in Libya, then none of this would have happened. I think that's very important because, of course, you know, there were several initiatives that were going on, this Mediterranean initiative. And while all of the other countries along the Mediterranean littoral had agreed to work with the European countries, Muammar Gaddafi had led the Libyan government to say, if all of Europe is going to be involved in this Mediterranean initiative, then all of Africa must also be involved. There was a demand for parity. There was also leadership from Muammar Gaddafi and the Jamahiriya government on the establishment of a million-person army to thwart the efforts of AFRICOM and the West to penetrate the African countries with the stationing of troops, which is exactly like a return to colonial days, not just even neocolonialism, where a few pawns were able to act on behalf of the colonial master. So now we have that step back. We also watched as the Jamahiriya was willing to put $90 billion on the table for United States of Africa. That, of course, has been lost. And in fact, today, many Libyans are saying, what happened to the money? Because in addition to the money that was seized by the Western powers, and of course, there's these ideas that are floating around Washington, D.C., saying that the Libyans are a wealthy country, so therefore they need to pay us back for liberating them. And I guarantee you that the money that was seized in the United States will make a very slow, long trickle, if any, back into Libyan coffers. That goes into Libyan coffers will be just like the rest of U.S. assistance. As Ron Paul, current presidential candidate for the Republican Party, says, that basically when the United States gives money, it gives money to foreign elites so that it can maintain control. They can maintain whatever leverage and control they have over the governmental apparatus, such that this penetration and exploitation of resources on the cheap can be had. And rather than pay the going rate that would be established by those who sell, we have a buyer's market that allows countries like the United States, for example, with respect to Democratic Republic of Congo, to go in and just steal the coltan.
Absolutely. Well, the Libyan case is so atrocious as an example because it's so blatant what was happening there. But I found it interesting that in the early days of the operation, it was being more openly led by the U.S. government and, in fact, AFRICOM itself. And General Carter Ham, who was the commander of AFRICOM at the time, issued a statement on March 19th, basically bragging about AFRICOM's involvement in the operation and, of course, framing it as an operation to protect Libyan civilians. But we saw in the weeks that followed that initial statement and that initial push, we saw America backing off a little bit, and France taking more of a lead role in the Libyan operation in general. Do you think that is a sign that perhaps the U.S. had to back off because of pressure or the optics of them being the lead in this? And is that in any way a hopeful sign that perhaps they can't just exert their, I guess, imperial agenda at will, that they need at least the mask of other countries being part of their coalition?
No, I don't see that as hopeful at all, because the fact of the matter is that Libya has been destroyed. Libya has become Iraq and Somalia. Libya has become, more than Iraq, it has become Somalia, because there is still fighting on the ground in Libya. There is a very vibrant resistance, as I understand it, and the resistance is doing the best it can under the circumstances. And so we have a government that is recognized in general, but we have no government on the ground, basically. So this is the example of a country that was trying its best to provide for its people. The Libyans had free healthcare, free education, free housing, subsidized housing, subsidized vehicles, subsidized gasoline, subsidized food. The idea that people from the United States who are pressing these buttons don't have any of that and are destroying a country that is trying to provide that for its people provides an unimaginable scenario for me. Finally, what I would say is this. Politically, President Obama, the first African descent president of the United States, bombing Africa, it did not play politically well. And President Obama has taken a tremendous hit, particularly from the activist Pan-Africanist component of the Black electorate. He had no choice but to step back politically and make it appear that someone else was carrying this out. But at the end of the day, we understand that even though there was this appearance of leading from behind, the problem is that it was led altogether. And there were U.S. soldiers who were on the ground. There were U.S. special ops on the ground. U.S. Servicemen who were flying French planes. So the United States was engaged, the United States was leading, and the United States made a terrible mistake.
Well, then finally, stepping back for a moment to look at the bigger picture, it's often been remarked that if the United States government put as much money and effort into actually trying to help the people in the nations that it's bombing instead of bombing them, that they'd be able to deliver food and aid and supplies with the same shock and awe that they now use to deliver weapons of destruction. On that note, what would an AFRICOM that was genuinely interested in building up Africa and fostering a healthy and strong Africa, what would an AFRICOM with that policy actually look like? And what could it actually do in a positive sense if, for example, you were in control of the U.S. government?
Well, first of all, it would cease to exist. And we would have a very active and vibrant Peace Corps. Because that's what it ought to look like, that you would have not an Africa command, a military command, but you would have an African civilian corps of people who are going there to do the things that Africans need done. And of course, the most important aspect of that is that that would not be defined by people in the West. That would be defined by the Africans themselves. And one of the things that the Africans need more than anything else is for Western countries to get the heck out and allow the Africans to govern themselves. Let them choose their leaders without interference from the West at all. That is the first prerequisite, self-determination. And then after that, we assist.
Excellent points. Well, thank you, Cynthia McInnes. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Bye.